Hello and welcome to the Critic's first ever podcast. I'm David Scully, and this week our political editor Graham Stewart and I spoke to former Trade Minister Lord Lilly about how Boris Johnson can learn the lessons from Margaret Thatcher's large majority. And Graham also caught up with two of our contributors, Hannah Betts and Robert Thickness, and chatted about the timelessness of wearing black and the politics of opera.
With us today, we are talking to Peter Lilly, Lord Lilly of Offa. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start by reflecting where we are now and where we were when you first entered Parliament. We seem to be at the end of a three-year national trauma, which has ended conclusively in Brexit happening and with a very large Conservative majority. You entered Parliament in 1983, which had just followed another major national crisis and moment of revival in the Falklands War, which was followed by a very large Conservative victory. What are the lessons that Boris Johnson could learn from the experience of where the Conservatives were in 83? Was hubris to come to follow, or actually was the lessons of 83 very positive for where we are now?
I think the lessons overall were very positive. Of course, we had an even bigger majority then, but it's the last time the government had a massive majority. And because of the success of the Falklands War, there was a feeling that we could and should tackle problems, and that if we were sufficiently driven, we could. And I think the biggest consequence of Brexit will be that Eurosceptics will no longer be able to blame Europe for everything. Eurofanatics will no longer be able to look to Europe for the solution to everything. We'll all have to work together to solve problems. And that will be a tremendously healthy thing.
One of the things that struck me as very interesting about Boris Johnson's speech in Greenwich the other day was that he was saying, actually, in many cases, Britain has higher levels of regulation and social protection than the European Union. Coming to your point about Conservatives no longer being able to blame Brussels for their problems, do you see this now as a time to roll back the state, or actually have we reached a stage where the Conservatives are relaxed about the nature of the welfare state and of social provision in this country?
Well, certainly we're not going to roll back the generosity of social provision. But we will be able to do, in respect of European regulation, what we did in respect of British regulation during the 80s, and that is reform it, not to abolish it, but generally to try and make rules and regulations less onerous to business and less of an obstacle to new entrants to any industry. And that probably will be the biggest single policy benefit from Brexit, more so than trade deals.
It seems to me that the Conservative Party's long path to Brexit, I mean, it's been a process, not an event. There's no one moment when you can say this was the moment when the party became a Brexit party. But something happened to Margaret Thatcher between 1986 with the Single European Act, which created the single market, as we know, and 1988 when she delivered the Bruges Group. What was it that changed? Did you perceive it at the time, or is this the historian's gift of retrospect?
I certainly felt it at the time. I was representing Britain at the meeting of Commonwealth finance ministers in Cyprus when the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, made the Bruges speech, and I hadn't any forewarning of it, but all the ministers clamoured round me in the morning. The news was full of this speech, asking me what it meant, because they had to tell their home governments. And I remember saying, well, it should be obvious to you, most of you became independent countries, and we're merely seeking to regain our own independence. So it was fairly obvious that it was the feeling that we had lost the power to govern ourselves in lots of areas, and she was signalling that she was not going to give up anymore and was going to get some back.
Do you think she felt misled about the nature of the Single European Act, and should she perhaps have had she was famous for her grasp of detail, should she perhaps have understood better what it was she was signing?
She was partly misled, although initially the single market was about mutual recognition of standards. I was the minister who had to introduce all the legislation in the 90s when it actually was introduced. And I made lots of speeches saying this will be wonderful, meaning it will be wonderful for British exports. Actually, since the single market came in, our exports have grown by less than 1% a year to Europe. It's had, they've slowed down since it came in. But consumers have benefited, not producers. Consumers have benefited because before they had to make 28 different varieties of washing machine, one range for each country. Now they only have to make one range for every country. But that's as much a benefit to Americans supplying or Japanese supplying Europe as it is to domestic producers. So it brings down the cost of washing machines, but gives no advantage to domestic producers. And that's what we didn't foresee. Then it moved on from being mutual recognition to centralised regulation. And that was when it ceased to be of any value to us at all and became a positive impediment.
Another great moment on the path to Brexit was Britain's leaving the ERM. It was, to many of us, a moment where it seemed that the process of gradual combining of monetary policy and leading towards single currency hit the rocks. Looking back at your time working with Nigel Lawson in the 1980s, what drove his commitment to joining the ERM, given that he was a Eurosceptic? Or was he not really, as we would describe it, a Eurosceptic at that time? Has that come later?
No, he was always a Eurosceptic. He took the view, I disagreed, but he took the view that we could hold the line at membership of the ERM against a single currency, and that the ERM would be helpful in getting down inflation. It was easier as a target than monetary targets. I was made economic secretary to the Treasury under him. Interestingly, we never talked about it in our morning meetings. He left that just himself, Peter Middleton and Terry Burns and the Prime Minister. But when I became economic secretary, I looked at my terms of reference and found I was responsible for international monetary policy. So I said to my officials, well, that's the ERM. It looks to me as if Chancellor is intending us to go in. Can you tell me what happens if we go in and it doesn't work? Will we be able to leave? And they hadn't thought of that problem, so they started doing a paper on the legalities of leaving if we joined and it went wrong. I then got summoned by Nigel and told that this was beyond my pay grade and I shouldn't trouble my little head with these things. But it turned out to be the only question that mattered.
With John Major, at what stage, I mean, he now describes himself very much as regarding Britain leaving the European Union as the greatest foreign policy mistake of our times. When he was Prime Minister, he had a balancing act between those in the cabinet, like Michael Heseltine, who were very supportive of the European project, and those like yourself, who were sceptical, or beyond sceptical. When was the moment, do you think, when he felt he was going to fudge along with not really declaring a policy on joining the single currency or not? And given the balance of the cabinet, was that politically the only line he could really have taken, whatever his private views may have been?
I think the latter is the case. He could really had very little option. He had a very weak hand, a very small majority, which was out. You know, there were more potential rebels. Indeed, during the Maastricht Treaty, more than half the backbenchers at one stage or other rebelled against it. So he was in a weak position, and he, as skillfully as he could, tried to steer the party through. I considered resigning at one stage, but worked out if I resigned, several junior ministers had said if I did, they would resign with me. Then we would lose our majority. There would have to be a general election. Probably John Smith would win. And then we go into the single currency lock, stock and barrel. So instead of having half a bad thing, we'd have had 100%, so I didn't resign. But he really had very little option. He could have done what I might well have tried to do if I'd been in his shoes, have said, well, actually, I'm taking this very clear line. If you don't like it, leave. But it might not have worked. It might just have led to a split of the party. It probably would. So, who knows, he probably did the least bad thing.
After Tony Blair's landslide victory in 1997, the Conservative Party spent a period where, really, whatever you said, whatever you did, a lot of the electorate simply were not interested. Do you think this is going to be the problem for Labour now? If you were giving advice to Rebecca Long-Bailey or to Keir Starmer or to Lisa Nandy or whoever emerges as the leader of the Labour Party, what experiences that you had would you see as being able to be done a different way so that an opposition party which has been badly beaten can still be at the centre of the national dialogue?
Well, we were badly beaten because we'd been in power for 18 years and the Labour Party had used that period to make itself electable. Tony Blair had ditched all Clause 4 and all the that, promised to keep what Mrs Thatcher had done. The Labour Party now is in a slightly different position. We've already been in power one way or another for 10 years, and if they can get their act together, sooner or later people want a change. That'll come much sooner than it did post-Blair's victory. But they've got to get their act together and make the Labour Party electable. And that needs either a Kinnock figure or a Blair figure to do so. And that doesn't seem to be available. I was very surprised that Hilary Benn wasn't standing, because he, I would have thought, would be the one, from our point of view, would be the most dangerous.
Mm. Who of the three likely contenders, who would you regard as the most dangerous to the Conservatives?
Well, they all have their failings. Keir Starmer looks the most moderate, but he, in a sense, was the architect of their defeat by forcing them to go for a second referendum, which was a slap in the face to a large chunk of their voters. And, but, you know, maybe that issue will have shrunk in importance and he can steer the Labour Party to be more electable. We need a good opposition. A good government needs strong opposition. And the British Constitution needs an alternative government. So it's rather important they do find someone, but I'm not sure that any of those three are likely to be able to do it.
And returning to the Conservative Party, many of what we might call the more diehard Eurosceptics have had a position of some scepticism towards Boris Johnson. And now many are coming over to him. Do you feel that they are right to believe that he will do what they've long desired and wished for? Or ultimately, is he a politician balancing many different concerns and that there will be some form of compromise which will be difficult for some of the true believers to swallow?
I think all politicians, all prime ministers have to balance interests and inevitably some people disappointed, but he has set off with a very clear line and he knows that he's got to retain the loyalty of his new voters, and they're not going to be impressed if he gives them only half a Brexit. And he's very clearly understood that and is therefore pushing a very clear line, absolutely in line with what he promised before the election. So I've got no worries. I think he always has been a Eurosceptic. I was impressed when he was writing stuff from Brussels, got to know him slightly, when my seat was split in two ahead of the 97 election. I wrote to him and said, why don't you apply for St Albans, because I was taking the northern half, which became Hitchin and Harpenden, and I'll use my influence to get you in there, because I wanted a good Eurosceptic in there. So I certainly believed then he was a Eurosceptic. He very wisely refused, because we probably lost St Albans to the Labour Party.
Right. How your advice might have changed the course of Conservative history.
Yeah, at the start of the podcast you said big majority is a chance to make some big changes and to tackle real problems, just like was done after the Falklands War. Are you worried at all about things like the decision over Huawei to grant state-run Chinese firm access to our 5G network? Do you think that's a possible danger of not tackling some of these big problems?
Well, I'm no expert on 5G and Huawei, and I don't know anyone who is. But what he announced seemed to me rather a good compromise, which greatly appeared to me to greatly limit Huawei's involvement and give those who are concerned about it, both here and the other side of the Atlantic, a large measure of what they wanted in terms of protection against any security risks. But I wouldn't rely on my own personal judgment on it at this stage. I'd need to take the sort of expert advice I assume he's taken.
Do you think the new landscape after Brexit, do you think there is more scope for, I'm not saying the state builds a rival Huawei, but more of a kind of muscular approach to these kind of issues?
That's a very one-off issue that happens to combine technology and security.
I guess moving away from a kind of laissez-faire free trade approach.
I doubt whether we can move to a position where we're going to be able to create national champions. Someone said governments are very bad at picking winners, but losers are very good at picking governments. And we don't want to get ourselves in the position of handing out large dollars of money to people who tell us they're going to make sunshine out of moonbeams, or, you know, energy out of sunbeams out of cucumbers. So we've got to try and create the circumstances in which we can enhance the economic fortunes of parts of the country which have lagged behind, things like free ports and improving infrastructure, and above all, improving training will be the key.
Looking at Boris Johnson's domestic agenda and the focus on infrastructure and higher spending more generally, would it be fair to say that Boris Johnson is a Eurosceptic version of Michael Heseltine?
He probably has Michael Heseltine's enthusiasm for big projects, and he told Conservative peers that he was worried about cancelling HS2 when there were no other alternative infrastructure projects benefiting the North, which were going to be shovel ready ahead of the next election. So he doesn't want to go into the next election saying, well, I stopped the very wasteful and expensive project, which nonetheless some people took as totemic of helping the North, and I haven't yet managed to start digging any holes on new railways east-west. Actually, I think that tells us that we've got to try and speed up the processes by which new projects have got up and running. The idea that we build a railway that takes longer than four world wars to build, I mean, it's just not credible. I always used to use this, my officials, when they tell me how long things would take, I said, that's half a world war, if it was 2.5 years. Can't we do a bit better than that? It's just absurd. You can build these things much more quickly if you actually have the drive and dynamism behind it. And actually, Michael Heseltine probably did have that drive and dynamism. I hope Boris does too.
You're now in the House of Lords, and how do you see the role of your fellow peers in keeping this government, bearing the Salisbury Convention in mind, but keeping this government to, with its large Commons majority, to account? Where the pressure points between the two chambers, do you think?
Well, the Lords is essentially a revising chamber that's only power is to tell the Commons to think again. When I was Secretary of State for Social Security, I'd pass and prepare measures lovingly, convinced they had no faults at all, get them largely unchanged through the House of Commons. They go to the House of Lords, and my officials will come back the next day and say, House of Lords, unfortunately, the Secretary of State has amended your bill. I'd be very angry, until I read their amendments. And I can't think of a single case when I didn't accept their amendments in whole or in part. They're a good revising chamber. What the Lords went wrong over the last 2 or 3 years is becoming a campaigning chamber and colluding with the Speaker and elements in the Commons to override the normal conventions of Parliament. But I think it will continue to a revising chamber. It can't thwart governments, except in extremis it can delay things for up to a year.
Are you looking forward to moving to York?
I personally, I wouldn't, it would be personally inconvenient, but I don't think it's a wholly bad idea. If we're going to have to move out for 5 or 10 years, then we might as well use that 5 or 10 years usefully by going to parts of the country where their lordships, and indeed the Commons, are unfamiliar, and demonstrating, you know, some interest in them, rather than building expensive new buildings in the middle of London or occupying valuable new buildings which could be used for other things. So I wouldn't object to it, but it won't happen because the forces of inertia will prevent it. I'll say it's not feasible and impractical. Diversity is difficult.
But it seems you'll be staying in Westminster, not the ridings of Yorkshire. Lord Lilly, thank you very much for your time. Well, for this segment of the Critic podcast, we've moved location and we've moved into one of Pimlico's more fashionable cellar bars to enjoy some table talk. And we're going to be enjoying some table talk with two of the Critic's leading table talkers, Robert Fitness and Hannah Betts. Hello to you both.
Hello.
There is two separate themes, but two separate themes bonded by a common vision. And that common vision is the timelessness of art and fashion. Robert, you've been writing in this month's edition of The Critic about the agitprop of modern opera directors trying to give modern relevance to age-old opera. We can give it a bit of Politico turbocharging. And so we'll be discussing with you about how timeless opera canon should be. Hannah, you've been writing about surely the most ageless aspect of fashion that is, which is going back to black.
Yes.
Hannah, I'm going to start with you, if I may. Wearing black, you're a Victorian, you're a widow, you're in the Khmer Rouge, but you're also strangely fashionable. What is it about black which never seems to age?
Or possibly 80s Birmingham, as I was, being a provincial goth. It's a rather wonderful way of making a statement by not making a statement, isn't it? I mean, it's a kind of quiet exhibitionism that I think we all enjoy. I always used to think that the first teenagers were the sort of 1590s young bucks who bombed around in black, that one can see in miniatures in the National Portrait Gallery. And they did that to identify with the Earl of Essex. They did it to identify themselves with being anti the regime. And so it's always had this kind of rebellious quality when not being fiercely practical. But also, I think for a lot of people, they like it because it makes them look... It's supposed to make them look thin. But I think in the sense that it makes people look bloody ill a lot of the time. But, you know, we're not too worried about that.
And is the point of it, though, that it is it a fashion if it's really timeless? Or is fashion surely something which is of the moment?
Well, I like to think of the column as being a style column. Because fashion, I mean, as you say, fashion comes and goes. And one may partake in it or not partake in it. But style is what we're all doing. It's unavoidable. And the more you try not to make a statement, the more you'll be making one. So I would refer to it as style column, I think. Also means I don't have to know as much.
And why is black the colour, though? Is it because in the 1920s it was... It became so and is just endured as such, or
well,
I mean, might it have been fuchsia if the dice had landed in a different way?
No, it covers a multitude of sins. It embraces enough antitheses to keep it kind of generating different meanings. So yes, it went from being a kind of maid's uniform to the uniform of the lady of the house. But then also fashion designers have made black very fashion because of they don't want to buy into a look. So this idea that in fashion you wear all black is a sort as a kind of palate cleanse, in the same way that perfumers won't wear perfume, or an artist will keep their clothes very blank. It's to keep themselves pure for that moment of creation. So in that sense, it's never going to go away.
And I wonder, though, as colours have become more colourful, dare I say, the black becomes more of a statement against that. Is that the case? Or if we'd gone back to a previous decade when colours were more dowdy, would it have had less power?
I think so. And we certainly are in a period when Instagram has made colour a very exciting thing. And there's a lot of playing up to that in fashion, both in wearers and designers. And so actually the sort of quiet sleekness of black does feel fresh again.
This is a woman thing though, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't work for men.
Really? I don't know.
Unless you're a priest.
I think my first boyfriend probably wore head-to-toe black. I mean, I think that beatnik look is never... Teenagers will be doing that forever. You know, the kind of black polo neck, black trousers, black boots. It's just not your look, Graham.
Well, you say that, but...
I think you could carry it off.
If tweed can be produced in black, then I'm ready to...
Chanel.
Ready to roll it. But, I mean, I remember when I was young, many...
Did you do black?
Well, I did hang out in the gothic punk scene.
Nice. Where was that?
In Edinburgh. You missed it. If I'd known, I'd invited you. You've
fabulous.
Missed an amazing opportunity. And, you know, the influences were Susie and the Banshees and The Cure and so on. And I wonder to what extent, when there was a very conscious pop look that was black, whether that was almost the risk of turning it into a fashion rather than a style.
Yes, and perhaps it's like the stop clock thing, that it does come into fashion every now and then. And we've been in a period where it hasn't been. So people like Anna Murphy of The Times, she's recently written a book, I think a couple of years ago, on colour, and everyone is embracing colour, and it's all very exciting. As I say, Instagram definitely played a part. But I think we are perhaps returning to that sense of moodiness. And perhaps everyone is just depressed. Perhaps the Roaring Twenties will see a return to black as a fashion.
Is it universal? I mean, is this a European and an American thing? Or different cultures
attach different meanings to it. So, for instance, the white has been a colour of mourning as well, but equally with that kind of blankness. I don't know. That's a very good question. I might go quiet on that one.
Well, I've very thoughtfully been out in Asia to test it. I think black is as worn out there as it is anywhere else. Mm. But is it a kind of
trendy black?
Well, what makes black trendy?
Well, you know, that kind of edgy minimalist. Is it lots of architects going around wearing black?
It's little black dress black.
Ah, okay. Mm. See, maybe that's more conservative. Although this winter, I lived in a little black dress, and partly probably because I'm a bit old and bored. And this month, I've lived in an all black uniform as well. I mean, maybe it's just.
But the LBD is conservative, or what is it?
Well, to my eyes, it's starting to look new again. But yes, I think for a long time it was perceived as being conservative and safe and insufficiently interesting. But perhaps people will start to look at it with fresh eyes.
Robert, turning to opera.
Robert is wearing a little black dress.
And you look marvellous in it, if I may say. It's you.
It is me. What?
Turn
your little black dress. Actually, I like your trousers.
The main thing about black is Hannah and I always wear black when we go to the opera because we get in a terrible rage and then we have to go to Joelle and cover ourselves in food and drink and it just shows up less.
Also, you can storm out, colour. Can't you? And you don't distract other people.
You can storm out. Joelle always keeps our table, expects us an hour and a half before we've booked and when we turn up on time, then they say, well, where have you been? How was it bearable today? Yes, sorry, Graham.
But I want Robert to turn to you and talk about the timelessness of opera. In this month's edition, The Critic, you've got very worked up about doubtless well-meaning attempts to make opera relevant to contemporary audiences, and you're not having it. Why?
Well, because it's relevant without anybody having to tell us that it's relevant. I mean, it's a disease of opera management that they want to treat their audiences like infants and have everything explained to them. I mean, there are a couple of things going on. The opera repertoire, as generally performed, out of the hundreds of thousands of operas written, we see about 30 again and again and again all the time. And they are bloody good. But they're the ones that that people think they can sell tickets to. This is why you see La Traviata and Carmen all the time. And the other 28. Because they're the only ones which can be guaranteed to sell. Now, given that, the directors kind of get bored with bull rings and people dying in Parisian garrets and so forth, and they kind of want to entertain themselves a bit more. So they can try to consider what the show is actually about and so forth. This is, I mean, what really happened was that after the Second World War, this idea of bringing things which had already been happening in straight theatre for decades, and with people like Stanislavski and Meyerhold and the Russians and so, bringing them into opera. And it was East German directors, Walter Felsenstein and people like this, who decided to bring these theatrical techniques, or try these theatrical techniques in opera. And it caught on very quickly, because it does, to a very great extent, renew, and when done by talented directors and designers, it renews the repertoire completely, and you see things in new, and it tells you many new things about the shows in question. And God knows, critics, the last people on earth who want to see another Parisian garret. We're actually delighted, secretly, we didn't often say so, to see something set in an underground car park with lots of beheadings and, you know, electrocutions and beatings and barbed wire and so forth. It's brilliant. It makes our day, as Hannah will attest. Some of our best evenings have been spent in underground car parks. Sometimes at the opera as well. You know how it is. People get an inflated view of the importance of their own opinions, and this happens to theatre directors a lot. And they like to. They have a ready audience of 2,000 people a night that they can lecture about the rather jejune.
So your point, Robert, would be that we should all just go to the opera, sit down, enjoy it, set in its traditional setting, and we imprint our own thoughts on it and leave?
Or, well, up to a point.
Is there not a role for a director to, even if it's a little bit in your face, to...
I am really in favour of it, because it has absolutely livened up opera. But then there is the line is very hard to draw. You just know when it's been crossed, when somebody really has nothing to say apart from some rather juvenile opinions. And they use some immortal text and music to be a vehicle for this idiocy. But this doesn't always have to be an idiocy. Sometimes they actually have, you know, talented directors and designers have interesting things to say about that. That's why they do their job. And it can be delightful. I mean, a lot of the audience will object to anything which is in anything apart from 19th century clothes. I mean, if it's 17th century opera and they're okay with it being in 19th century clothes, so long as it isn't in 20th century clothes, this kind of, you know, the audience is very peculiar about these kind of things. But anything, so long as it's not modern. Because, you know, you're paying for big clothes, you're paying for... And this used to work in the old days, when they had the kind of singers who could come out on stage and just stand there in their big old clothes and sing amazingly without acting, people like Joan Sutherland and Pavarotti and so. It was absolutely fine because everything could be done through the voice. Everything was done through the voice. They would convince you of everything. Joan Sutherland would convince you that she was a 16-year-old dying in an attic.
Yeah, kind of.
No, but she would through the voice because it would suddenly... What usually happens is because the eyes are stronger than the ears, generally speaking, which is why you don't hear film music. Basically, it's in the background. But sometimes, under very specific circumstances, the ears can take over. And when Joan Sutherland is singing, in a terrible production where lots of fat old people are standing still, warbling, this can happen, or could happen then. It doesn't happen so often now, because there are not so many amazing voices around. Which is another reason why...
Fewer fat people too, actually.
Well, you know, they kind of had to... They had to move off into sort of Romanian national opera and things like that. But that has passed, basically, and so and that having passed, the facility of having four amazing voices on stage that can make you blind to the inadequacies of staging has kind of also led to this concentration on the visual. And it is marvellous, of course, because we have some very good designers and directors working in opera. And it could be terrifically boring. In fact, if you want to see something terrifically boring, you go and see a Romanian opera production where old people in big old things stand around in front of cardboard sets. And it's absolutely ghastly.
And there are two aspects, aren't there? I mean, there's the visual aspect, but there's also the sense that the modern analogies that are going to be drawn are invariably obvious and clunky. Is it your view that you know, if we're going to do Beethoven's Fidelio, making a very obvious reference to Brexit is just boring and predictable?
I don't know which side Florestan would be on in the Brexit debate. What do you think?
Guantanamo one.
The whole
that
park,
was great.
The Guantanamo one. Yes, they
came out in orange jumpsuits.
It was a big thing in the old days. The orange jumpsuits, and do you know? I mean, nobody knows why the prisoners are in Fidelio or in prison. I mean, they may be like rapists and handbag snatchers. You know, and I don't know.
Just
like
remind
that.
Me the history. Beethoven wrote Fidelio before or after he broke up with Napoleon.
Well, he wrote it for years and he kept revising it. So, but generally speaking, afterwards, because he got sick of Napoleon quite early on.
Right.
Napoleon was a fraudulent revolutionary anyway. But and they were all still in love with the French Revolution, and realised that Napoleon had kind of co-opted the bits of it that he wanted to, but without actually believing in any of it, And Beethoven realised that when he was writing the Third Symphony and tore up the title page with the dedication and so on. But Fidelio is about, it's not even about kind of unjust imprisonment or anything like that. It is about the yearning for freedom of the human spirit, and he uses prison as a metaphor for that. I mean, everything is a metaphor, of course, and therefore it can be represented in a million. It doesn't have to be some 18th century guy in a prison with his wife dressed as a chap, batting her eyelids at the female, the daughter of the jailer, in order to, it's ridiculous. It doesn't have to be like that at all. Because it is a metaphor. It can be said like in a kind of Matrix-like way, absolutely, if you do it competently. But it takes quite a lot of work.
And in a week in which we've heard that the Royal Shakespeare Company is concerned that actors today don't know any Shakespeare or don't know sufficient Shakespeare. Is there not a case that actually the excitements and concerns of Verdi and Rossini and Beethoven and so on are so lost on a modern audience now that really to set it in its own time, it's not timeless, it is of its period, and actually it needs to be set in our times in order to have any resonance at all.
It's a very interesting thing. I mean, they had censorship in those days. Verdi kind of wanted to set La Traviata was a play by Dumas, right?
Mm.
Is that the guy I think? About his girlfriend, yes, about the, with the consumption. I think it was Dumas, the young one. And Verdi very quickly wrote it into an opera and wanted it to be performed in contemporary clothes, nobody would allow it to be performed in contemporary clothes because it was all a bit, how dare you say that there are prostitutes in Paris and all this kind of thing. 1850, whoever heard of such a thing? So they had to perform it in something like 17th century clothes, even then. So in 1850, it was performed in 17th century clothes, and it was quite a rare, it was a very rare thing for anybody to write an opera about contemporary issues. The first one who really did it was probably Puccini with La Bohème, which was kind of about contemporary young people and was done in contemporary clothes. But very generally speaking, all those guys were writing about things back in the 13th century anyway, which nobody had heard of. So the question of knowing the events referred to is kind of irrelevant because it's a self-contained, you read the synopsis, they tell you what's going to happen. Nobody's ever surprised by action in an opera because, well, certainly these days we've seen it 150 times before. But you just kind of want to know the action beforehand because you're never going to get what the hell's going on from watching the people on stage and listening to them. You can't understand a word they're saying. And there's just people moving very slowly in old clothes, bumping into each other and bits of cardboard scenery falling over. So the actual story has always been a sort of irrelevancy in opera. Because it is very so strongly metaphorical creature. I mean, a lot of the audience doesn't want metaphors and so forth, but let's take it or leave it. They like the falling down cardboard scenery. and good luck. Why not?
So if we cast it all in black, though, would that not
very, but this is very
solve the problem? We can
this is
focus,
very common.
Focus on
the with green.
Early opera, actually, isn't it? Particularly with early opera, where you tend to get sort of people earnestly walking about.
But it's terrifically cheap. I mean, because nobody can afford sets or anything like that now. And everybody's got some kind of terrible black clothes that they can wear on. But what it does reveal is how many. It's like British orchestras. When you see a British orchestra on stage, you realise how many shades of black there are. Because nobody in a British orchestra has ever thought to say you have to wear this black, not just any old black. And you see a French orchestra comes along, they're all dressed in a nice same black, or a German orchestra, and they look nice. And British orchestras just look absolutely terrible with their sort of top shop trouser suits.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to leave it there in the forthcoming opera of Top Shop and their trouser suits, but
God, it would be amazing. Philip Green.
It's got to be done.
Yes.
Philip Green, the opera.
Write it, Bert.
Starring Benedict Cumberbatch.
Almost a body double. I mean, it's very impressive. So, Hannah and Robert, we'll leave it there for now. But the past is the present, and the present is in black. So, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to the Critic podcast, but why not get the Critic in print? Right now we're offering 3 issues for just £5. Go to thecritic.co.uk for details.